Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, we talked with Caldecott Medal winner Uri Shulevitz about his memoir, Chance, Escape from the Holocaust. This week, AWM program director Allison Sansoni chats with award-winning NBC News correspondent Jacob Soboroff. This conversation took place September 3rd, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest of our virtual events and the latest in the Jean and John Rowe program series, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. The exhibit that accompanies this series opened at our Chicago Museum in November and opened online in the spring at my-america.org. At that site, you can see the stories from writers from 18 different countries talking about family, connection, influence, how and why they came here, and what it means to them to write as an American. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director at the American Writers Museum. We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Our guest tonight is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Separated, Inside an American Tragedy, which details the impact on families and children of decades of immigration laws at the southern border, culminating in the Trump administration policy of separating asylum-seeking parents from their children. Jacob Soboroff is a correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. For his reporting on the child separation policy, he received the 2019 Walter Cronkite Award for Individual Achievement by a national journalist, and the 2019 Hillman Prize for Broadcast Journalism. He's appeared on Today, Morning Joe's, The Rachel Maddow Show, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and numerous other programs. He co-presented with Katie Turr the four-part event docuseries American Swamp on MSNBC, and he's joining us now from, Jacob, you were telling me offline, your laundry room / studio. Welcome.
Hey, Allison, welcome to my laundry room. Right behind that door is the stacked washer and dryer. And I hope that it's not on. I have earphones in, so I can't hear right now, but I don't think that it is.
Well, thank you for joining us in these strange times. And we appreciate you.
Here's the proof, by the way.
Talk with us about the important subject.
Thank you. It is important, but I just want to prove to you that this is the laundry basket.
That's perfect.
Thank you for having me here. And I'm only sorry I couldn't be in Chicago in person.
Well, thank you for coming. In reading your book, I first wanted to ask you how you came to the story. You know, you detail really early on that this wasn't something necessarily that you had set out to cover, but you kept coming back to it. How did you find your way to the story?
Well, you're right. I consider myself, I guess, an unlikely eyewitness to what turned out to be one of the most shameful chapters in modern American history, if not the entire history of this country. And that's because, you know, while I was covering a lot of border issues for MSNBC and NBC News, really for me that meant, is President Trump lying? Is he lying about, you know, the need for a border wall? Is he lying about where drugs are coming in? Is he telling the truth about how many MS-13 members are coming into this country? Is the border dangerous? You know, things like that. And, you know, I always enjoyed and found important covering issues related to immigration as a person native to Los Angeles. I grew up here and born and raised here. And it's a city that's over 50% people of color at this point. And so those issues are unavoidable to somebody who lives in a city like this one, and particularly to a journalist that lives in a city like this one. But family separation was never on my radar. And I write a lot about how in the book, and I detail many times, quite frankly, where I just missed the story. And it was not until June 13, 2018, after quite some time, months of working on a Dateline NBC documentary about the reality of life along the border, that I was invited by Kirstjen Nielsen's press secretary, a woman named Katie Waldman, who ultimately became Katie Miller when she married Stephen Miller, the president's advisor, to tour this facility, Casa Padre, the former Walmart, 250,000 square feet in Brownsville, Texas. And that is where, for the first time, really family separation smacked me right in the face. And I saw 1,500 boys, 10 to 17 years old, hundreds of them who had been separated and were there for no other reason than that, living for 22 hours a day inside, doing Tai Chi and watching Moana, the movie, in the loading dock of the former Walmart and standing in line to eat food. And sorry for the long answer, but I mean, basically, it was at that moment when I walked outside and I told my colleague Chris Hayes, and many of the people watching us right now may have seen that moment live. You know, I've been inside jails and a prison. This place is called a shelter, but effectively these children are incarcerated inside. And it was from there that I started to realize there is so much more about this that I frankly missed. And Julia Ainslie, my colleague, didn't miss it. Caitlin Dickerson at the New York Times didn't miss it. Lomi Creel at the Houston Chronicle didn't miss it. Now at ProPublica. But I did. And that's why I wanted to write the book. There was so much that I didn't. I became associated with covering this policy because I was one of the first journalists to actually set eyes on the living conditions of these children in custody. But there was so much that I didn't know about this. And so, even after the fact, even 2 years after the fact. And so that's why in the summer of 2019, a year later, I set out to write this book to answer questions that I couldn't answer for myself.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your research process and how it differed, you know, from the research that you do when you're reporting.
Well, it's interesting. This was never intended to be a writing project. I was never a writer, never considered myself a writer. I always considered myself a broadcast journalist. But it all kind of started unintentionally the minute I walked into that Walmart, where I had to pull over on the way there because this was a pad and paper only tour, no cameras allowed. And I pulled over at a Walmart. I bought a little tiny, actually, hold on a second. I think I have it. Hold on 1 second. A tiny blue notebook. Where's my binder down here? Do I have, oh, there it is. Hold on. This is the binder I used when I was researching and writing the book. And this is the little blue notebook that I picked up at a Walgreens in Brownsville, Texas. And inside it are the notes that started this as a writing project when I didn't even know it. And I write things here. And this is all in the book, too. I mean, I write about all this in the book. But let me flip through and read some of it to you. So it says here, I don't know if you can read my writing, but kids everywhere, Oreos, applesauce. Smile at them. They feel like animals in a cage being looked at. And that was a representative of Casa Padre, which was run by Southwest Key, which is the shelter operator. And that was weird to me because there were no cages in that facility, but everybody had been talking about kids locked up in cages. And just to get back to the writing process, I had no choice but to write down what I saw because there were no cameras allowed. And so when I was once I ultimately had a conversation with my editor, Peter Hubbard at HarperCollins, about doing this project, it was the first thing that I did. And the whole introduction to the book actually is me going back to my storage unit, a 5-minute drive away from here at a public storage, looking through all my stuff, digging out from under like a changing table and Christmas decoration, baby change table, and Christmas decorations, and a pendant lamp, and all kinds of stuff to find that notebook. And that's the spine of the book. What I wrote in that book in the Walmart and then in the McAllen Ursula Central Processing Station 7 days later, or less than 7 days later, on Father's Day 2018, and then inside a federal courtroom in San Diego. I mean, those are the stories that I started with when I began writing what became this.
The other narrative through line of the book is really, you know, the story of a father and son that you met, Juan and Jose, who had been separated, and the book sort of follows them through this process. How was connecting with them? What was that like for you as a reporter, and how did you sort of gain their trust and establish that rapport that let you get so far into their lives?
Sure. And I don't think this really spoils the story in the book, but ultimately what you'll see is there's three real narrative strands of the book. One is mine as a reporter, kind of missing and then learning about the story. The other is government officials, both who were trying to stop this policy from happening and also who implemented it. And the third is Juan and Jose. Their story starts at the beginning of their story in Petén, Guatemala, when they were threatened by narco traffickers and decided to leave. But my story with Juan started actually when I met him after he was separated from his son for almost 5 months. And I met him in person inside the Adelanto Ice Processing Center in the high desert of Southern California, about 2 hours from where I'm sitting right now. And I drove up there, and he had been coerced into signing away the right to reunify with his son. And he was one of, I think, about a dozen in that facility who was in that situation. And were it not for his lawyer, Lindsay Tislowski, at the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, he probably would have been deported like 400 plus other parents without their children because he had been coerced into doing so. And so when it comes to how did I build his trust, it was more that we just started a relationship when he was detained. And I learned about him then. It wasn't about writing a book. It was about sharing his story with the general public at the time as a reporter on television so that, you know, potentially his case could be reversed, the documents he signed could be thrown out, and he could get to see his son, who was thousands of miles away in South Texas, not far from where I toured that Border Patrol station. And I met him again, I guess it would be in October, went right before he was going to be reunited with his son on the streets of downtown L.A. And then again, I guess we just kept in touch via text. And over the process of writing this book, I went out to see them where they now live in Washington, D.C. I've been actually working on American Swamp, the documentary series you had mentioned with Katie Turr. And so while I was there, I started to just go out to dinner with them. And we would go to this chain. I write about this a little bit, too, in the book. We would go to this chain steakhouse in the D.C. area. And we just started talking. And when I told him that I wanted to include his story in the book, and I asked him if it was okay, both of them, Juan and Jose, he said yes. And the reasons that he decided to participate and allow me to tell the story, and I should say that their names were changed, but that's about it, is that he wanted to learn the same answers. He had the same questions I did. How did this happen? And how can we prevent it from ever happening again? And when I say it, you know, I really want to be specific. American Academy of Pediatrics called this government-sanctioned child abuse, what happened to him and his son. Physicians for Human Rights, which won a Nobel Peace Prize for their work on landmines, called this torture, what the American government did. And so we shared a goal of learning more about how this could have ever happened. It's why I call the book Separated Inside an American Tragedy, because that's really what this is. The government perpetrated this. It wouldn't have been possible, certainly because of the Trump administration, but also because of many administrations before this. And so we set out to answer these questions together. And his way of doing that was by opening up to me, both of them. And we got together many times, at least three times as I was writing this book to sort of go through every detail, FaceTime with his family back in Guatemala. I traveled to Guatemala as I reported this story and wrote the book. And they've now come to be people I care a lot about.
Let's talk a little bit about the third through line that you mentioned, which is that, you know, these government officials who were, you know, in some cases trying to prevent the policy from being implemented, in other cases were sure that this would be an effective deterrent against right. people seeking asylum. What I was struck with when I was reading the book is just how often those who wanted this policy implemented, even as they denied there was a policy, just how often they told on themselves. You know, you mentioned a couple of times that, you know, they blew the whistle on themselves. How did that, you know, tell us a little bit about that and what that was like.
Well, what's interesting about family separations is that it didn't, as a systematic policy to separate thousands of children, it started in the Trump administration. But the practice itself on a limited basis was occurring during the Obama administration. And in fact, there were NGOs that were warning as the Trump administration was coming in about the fact that this was something that happened from time to time, and that if it got basically into the wrong hands as a practice, it could be truly disastrous. And so there was a guy in the Office of Refugee Resettlement at the beginning of the book, you can read all about him. His name is Jim De La Cruz. And he was a federal field specialist, basically a frontline social worker, who wrote in an email the best way to not the best way to avoid issues with reuniting parents and children is to not separate them in the first place. And despite that type of advice from sort of career people who had the best interests of the children at heart, on Valentine's Day 2017, right after Donald Trump became the president of the United States, they all met in the conference room of Kevin McAleenan, the acting commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, sort of talking about doing this. People left shell-shocked that were holdovers from the previous administration. And over the course of months that became a year, there continued to be all these warning signs. And in particular, there's a couple of people who I think are important to highlight. Commander Jonathan White, a career civil servant from the U.S. Public Health Commission Corps, which actually are people that deal with natural disasters for the most part and sort of healthcare crises. But he was saying when he was in ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, if this separation policy happens, and remember John Kelly in 2017 said on CNN, yeah, we're considering it. If it happens, we're going to run out of bed space. This is potentially traumatic to the children. Claire Trickler McNulty within ICE, again, a career employee, had said this could be abusive to the children. The idea of the systems not being able to talk to each other if they're separated could be disastrous and could create a situation where these children are abused. And at every twist and turn, and this goes back to like things I didn't know at the time, I kept saying, there's no plan. They have no way to reunite. This is a huge man-made disaster. I was right in that it was a disaster, but I was wrong in that there was no plan to reunite. There were career officials who almost at every opportunity tried to stop this from happening. It was the Trump administration officials who kept pushing back and kept pushing forward. And there are many stories. Read Chapter 5, Get Rid of the List, where Scott Lloyd, who was the Trump-appointed head of Office of Refugee Resettlement, his first instinct was when the list of 700 people who had been separated leaked out to Caitlin Dickerson at the Times, his first instinct was not to call DHS and say, hey, I'm responsible for 10,000 plus kids in the custody of the federal government. What in the hell is going on? He instead, his subordinates understood it to be, gave them an instruction to get rid of the list, to destroy the list, a critical linkage that Jim De La Cruz kept that could have been used to reunite parents and children. And so when you say they blew the whistle on themselves, there were many times where they let this out, this information out. But the Trump administration kept pushing forward because they saw political advantage to ending so-called catch and release, the idea that people who came here for asylum shouldn't be able to wait inside the country and instead should either be locked up indefinitely or kicked out of the country immediately. And they thought family separations was going to be the way to effectuate that policy change.
How did they imagine the information of what was happening? This is something that's puzzled me since the news first broke. Sure. How did they imagine the information was going to get to desperate people fleeing narco traffickers that if you go to the border and seek asylum, bad things will happen to you?
Trickling back through word of mouth, I suppose. But what is perplexing, maybe perplexing is too generous. I guess the generous interpretation would be perplexing. The more sinister or cynical interpretation would be sort of diabolical way to look at this is we know deterrence, and that's what this is, a deterrent-based strategy. The idea of scaring people from coming doesn't work. It didn't work when Bill Clinton did prevention through deterrence on the border in 1994, building walls that would send migrants through quote-unquote hostile terrain. Read the memo in the book. It didn't work when George W. Bush created DHS and exponentially increased the size of the Border Patrol. It didn't work when Barack Obama became the so-called deporter-in-chief and deported more people than any president in history. And again, were it not for all of those deterrence-based failed policies, people still kept coming to this country, Donald Trump wouldn't have been able to do family separations. But there is a belief amongst, again, generous would be a belief, cynical would be ill intent amongst people in immigration law enforcement that scaring the crap out of people, harming people, will make other folks less likely to come. And what they don't understand in that calculation is what I've seen with my own eyes when I went to Chicamula, Guatemala, or Zacapa, Guatemala, that people are fleeing desperation. They're fleeing not only persecution and violence, which we talk about a lot, but they're also fleeing extreme poverty, malnutrition, in some cases starvation. Right now, it's worse than it's been, I think, in a very long time in a place like Guatemala where I was because of climate change, because of climate variability, like El Nino. Their cash crops like coffee are drying up, but now also because of COVID. And unless we all realize that as Americans and that our country is perpetrating acts like family separation instead of doing things like mitigating or attempting to help mitigate the crises these folks are facing on the ground. Nobody wants to leave. I mean, if you, I would ask people over and over again, did you want to come here? Or did you want your sister to go to Philadelphia or daughter or brother to, you know, come to New York? The answer is always no. But Trump defunded aid that helps mitigate the effects of climate change in Central America. I mean, he did the exact opposite. And so that's why I call into question the motivation here behind this policy. And that's why I say it's a choice between ill intent and sort of naivete. And I think I sort of tend to think it's more towards the former.
When you, so this is a, this was a fast moving story. And, you know, as you're following it along, at what point did you say to yourself, you know, there's a book in here. There's more than what I'm doing.
Still, I'm not sure. I was like, how did I don't honestly, and I don't mean to make light of it, but like, I am not a writer. I never was a writer. I never worked in newspapers. I was a political advance man. And that's how I sort of developed my reporting technique. That the author's note is called Facts on the Ground, because that's the way that I did my reporting as a journalist. I always was, if you ever saw me on MSNBC before I started doing immigration reporting heavily, it was talking to people about the 2016 election, talking to people about their lives, about the economy, and then talking to undocumented people about life in this country in that sort of predicament. And so I'm not sure I ever really, the person who encouraged me to look into writing a book was Katie Turr, my friend, and my friend from growing up here in LA, but also my colleague at MSNBC. And I met, the true story is I met someone from HarperCollins at her book party in New York when her book Unbelievable came out in 2017. And we exchanged cards or whatever. And only after family separations happened did I end up reconnecting with those folks. And I didn't go about this. I never really talked about this before publicly, but I never really went about this as a writer trying to get a big offer or something like that. I developed a relationship with Peter Hubbard, my editor, in the summer of 2019 when it was, I at first we thought there isn't a book here. You know, this is a very dark subject. It's even though it resonated in the summer of 2018 and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people went to the streets. I was like, I'm not sure. Peter, I told him this. I remember sitting there that a year from now, people are going to care. And I was wrong. In the summer of 2019, arguably people cared more than they did the summer before. The Clint Border Patrol station was overflowing. The conditions were horrific. The federal government was arguing that kids don't need toothbrushes and blankets in order to have safe and sanitary conditions. And then we reported, Julia Ainslie and myself reported about abuse in the Yuma Border Patrol station, sexual abuse allegations, abuse for retaliatory behavior for complaints by migrants. And that's when I went back and saw Peter again. And I said, look, people are still talking about this. And I'm getting the feeling that sort of the way people felt a summer ago is still the way people feel. And perhaps that's the way they're going to feel a summer from now. And so we decided to ultimately sort of embark on this book project. And there was no grand plan. It just sort of unfolded in that way where I didn't, like I said, I didn't take it out and try to be competitive or anything like that. I just said, I trust you. They trusted me and we kind of just went for it.
So there's breaking news as this book is coming out. This, you know, as you mentioned, you know, people are still interested in this and also there's still developments in this story. How do you know where to stop when you're writing a book like this?
How did I know where to stop? The truth is, if you get, it's funny, I didn't know about this, but I'll show you in the book. So we had, I think, 5 printings because the demand was, I mean, the fact that it became a New York Times bestseller was, a shock as an overstatement. The fact that anybody wanted to read a book about immigration blew my mind. But if you look here, these little numbers on the bottom tell you what printing it is. Ultimately, we did 5 printings, but even I went up to so far. And then, my point in showing you this is in the subsequent printings, some of the typos that are in the original first printing are no longer there. But I went, and the folks at HarperCollins will tell you this, I sort of went up to about as far as you can go making changes. I even made changes once the book was typeset, having to lift words out character by character in order to make changes. Like Physicians for Human Rights declared that this was torture, I think, after I had submitted the final manuscript for sure, but maybe after the book was typeset. And I said, we have to include that in the story. There were reports from inspectors general that came out as the book was nearing its final stages with new information. I got emails from top officials that I included in the book at the 11th hour before this book came out. And I think honestly, in the paperback version, there'll probably be new reporting and new information because subsequent to the book coming out even, Julia and I reported, I think last week or the week before, that there was this bombshell meeting in the Situation Room of the White House with top cabinet level officials. And the sourcing for that, the idea that that story happened, sort of came out of the publication of the books, you know, people coming forward saying, there's more that you don't know that's not here. And I think there's still a lot yet to be told. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure that this book is, the book, there's many thousands of copies out there in the world right now. But I think that there's a lot more to the story that I wasn't able to get in. And I guess it kind of just stopped when they told me, like, okay, man, time for the book to come out.
Editors love it when you make changes after something's been typeset.
Yeah, exactly. What do they call it? Oh, copy lifting, right? Or copy lifting? I don't know. Anyway, again, I'm new to this, but the whole idea that they were like, if you do this, you have to match it exactly for characters and exactly line by line. And that's what I ended up doing.
You mentioned at the beginning and throughout this conversation and throughout the book as well, you mentioned the work of others that you read or became aware of later. Whose work was really crucial to your understanding of the story?
Well, I think my fellow journalists, most importantly. I didn't do a lot of reading of other books about immigration or the border. In fact, virtually none while I was writing this book. Because I wanted this to be grounded in the facts on the ground, in my own experience of what I learned, and also be vulnerable. You know, I'm not afraid to admit that I screwed some stuff up. I write in the book about how in that first kind of now like widely shared report with Chris Hayes, I said I had been in a federal prison when in fact I was in a state prison. I mean, the for me, it was almost like a therapy session in a way. It's like as a reporter who became so associated with this, had so much to learn. So I relied mostly on the reporting. I went back and read a lot of the reporting of the other reporters who I already mentioned who were dialed into this policy before I was. Julia Ainslie, who is now my colleague and very good friend, but then was at Reuters and broke the family separation story. Then came Lomi Creel's incredible article where she uncovered this pilot program about the policy that was going on in El Paso. And Lomi's now at ProPublica. And there's a story in the book about how I was in El Paso days after she published the story. At the airport, if I would have grabbed the newspaper, I probably would have learned about family separations. And instead, I drove down to Marfa, to that Border Patrol sector, to do a story about low morale in the Border Patrol. Because people, you know, President Trump had wanted to hire more Border Patrol agents, and these were remote destinations, and he was talking very aggressively. And anyway, I just wasn't focused on the right thing. And then ultimately, Caitlin Dickerson, Caitlin and I have actually gotten to know each other a little more since the book has come out and since I've spent more time reading her reporting. But Caitlin broke the story of 700 children. It was the first time we knew a number that had been separated by April 2018. And it was in response to that that Scott Lloyd had this episode where he wanted to destroy the list. I built a lot of the reporting I did, the actual reporting that I did in the book, not my personal story or Juan and Jose's story, off of the work of other journalists, because were it not for them, I don't think any of us would have really known, and were it not for the activists too. So I learned a lot about immigration reporting and reporters, and there are many, many fine immigration reporters out there. And I also learned a lot about, actually, they're not journalists, but immigration attorneys and immigration activists who I now consider, you know, as important really as any first responder on any front line because of the work that they do and the way that they unearth, like detectives, on what's really going on.
Yeah. What did writing this book teach you about writing?
That it's hard. This room that I'm sitting in, I spent a lot more time than I ever, I like doing laundry. I really do. But I spent a lot more time in this room than I ever would have thought I would. And that's because I have two little kids. I had a son when I was covering this, but now I have a daughter who's 6 months old.
Oh, congratulations. Almost.
Thank you very much. My wife had her, not me. I think I end up saying all the time I had her, but we had her. My wife had her. And I would wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning because I would have these. I didn't know where to start. You know, I started the book writing about, there's a part of the book where I write about throwing up in the middle of the Arizona desert, going out to see these rescue beacons that the Border Patrol set up for migrants. And how I realized sort of my constitution was so weak compared to the people who were coming here from the most desperate circumstances on earth. And that was the first thing I sort of thought to myself. That story kind of stuck out to me and I wrote it first. I didn't even know where to start. So I went to Katie Turr and I said, what did you do? And she told me about Scrivener, an app or a program where she wrote her book in. And yeah. I started, what's that?
Scrivener,
exactly. And it helped me sort of toggle between chapters and stories. And as I would think about things, I would start to write them. And once I started doing that, the book kind of took the form of a diary. It became a chronological sort of series of events. And that's when I kind of got into the flow. And so I would spend a lot of time in this room, on not this computer, but another one sitting right where I'm looking right now. And as much as I could, just get time to myself and lock myself in here. What I didn't anticipate is that immediately, I thought I would be in Chicago right now for this book on book tour. But I didn't anticipate that this would turn into my television studio also and office where I'd be doing most of the talking about the book, you know, in the aftermath of the book coming out too.
Yeah. We've been broadcasting from my spare bedroom since March. So I feel
you. You have a nicer, more dialed in background than I do.
But you have all that natural light.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's take a couple of questions. To remind folks, if you type your question into the Q&A, maybe one of our watch your chat window as well. One of our staff might contact you to raise your hand and ask your question yourself. I'll also read out some of those questions that are in our Q&A box. Our first question is from Carolyn.
Hi, Carolyn.
I'm unmuting myself. Am I unmuted?
I hear you. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. First, thank you so much for first this book, but also for coming on and chatting about it. It's fascinating. It's of particular interest to me. I have friends who are in the legal system and one who is actually involved with the courts down at the border. So I know it's a difficult assignment because I also know reporters who have gone down there. And I'm wondering what challenges you faced as you went down there in terms of just basic communication with the individuals that you were encountering, in particular, of course, Juan and Jose, but just generally.
Thanks. Good question, and I appreciate that. The truth is, I don't, and I write this in the book too, my Spanish is not very good. And that's another, you know, I think a lot about it, was I the right person to tell the story? And the answer is probably not, right? Like, I'm a white, privileged person from Southern California, and this is a story about what the American government did to largely Central American refugees. But the reality is, I just ended up there, for better or worse, right? And I felt like it was important to share this story because I was there and I did have a distinct vantage point. And, you know, as far as the challenge of, I guess, being me specifically and reporting the story, I always sort of took this assignment as one of literally thousands of versions of this story that I think ultimately should be told. Every person who was separated has a story. All the officials involved in this policy have a story. And so for me, in addition to the obvious sort of language barrier that I tried to overcome, it was reporting this story as someone who didn't understand it as well as other people. I wasn't in a position to understand it like people who had been immigration reporters for a long time or who were Central American American reporters who had a deeper understanding of why people would come or where they would come from or maybe had been to some of these places. So I tried to focus on really what I could see with my own eyes. And that's why what I wrote down in that notebook, and my television reports were largely, I approached them the way I would approach being an advance man when I was a political advance man in college. I worked for Mike Bloomberg and then for Howard Dean. And the thing was always, in addition to Mike Bloomberg's famous line, and I, sorry if I'm swearing or I'm about to swear, but he once said to me, don't fuck it up, with being an advance guy. That's the way I approach this.
It sounds like Mike.
Yeah, exactly. I would, that's what I try to do. I would try to suck up all the information that I could, repeat it back to the audience. And if you go back and watch that first report I did with Chris Hayes, for me, it was all about just answering questions that he had about what I saw. And I tried not to go beyond that. I tried not to interpret it. Of course, it was hard as a father of a young child. It was very emotional for me to see this. You know, I think I probably suffered some form of PTSD, but ultimately, Carolyn, what I went through was nothing like what these families went through. And today they're all still suffering the trauma of this. And they'll have one official you'll read in the book will told me that a childhood trauma means a century of suffering. And that's what these kids will have for the rest of their lives.
And that kind of brings me to a follow-up, if I may.
Sure.
As you said, there are many reporters down there. I know they're filing, and it's very difficult to break through under the current news climate with all the distractions. What do you think it will take at this point to even register? And there are political reasons, too, perhaps, that politicians don't want it in the fore, because it is a very much an issue that cleaves the population, right? So what do you think? Go ahead.
Well, I think so, although I'm not so sure that Donald Trump in particular, you know, hasn't realized that this is not a winning issue for him. What kind of occupied that boogeyman space in the midterm elections and in his 2016 campaign, which was migrants at the border, caravans coming, has now been replaced by his racism targeted towards inner cities and violence, or his perceived violence that we're seeing in communities across the country. And I think that's because he knows that people now feel compassionate and discuss in ways we did not before, issues around migration and our treatment as a country of migrants. And that's why, again, that goes back to like Juan and Jose. That's why we all wanted to participate in this project. It's why I want to have this conversation tonight. I want people to buy and read the book, but I want people to, who weren't like me, sort of hip to what our country has been doing for decades, if not generations, have a deeper understanding of how we got to this point. It's why it's called Separated Inside an American Tragedy, as I said, because this is us, this is who we are, this is being done in our name. And if we don't learn more about it and talk about it and not be afraid to say, frankly, we got here because of Democrats and Republicans, we're never going to get anywhere.
And also to find out what is going on in terms of COVID infection and death at the border. I've seen pitiful little on that.
Yeah. And just quickly on that, I mean, I've done some reporting again with Julia about the conditions inside detention. There are still children today, I think 91 is the latest number, who are locked up in ICE detention with their families where there's COVID. The government refuses to release them and gives them the choice of either being separated from their parents and released to somebody else, or being detained indefinitely. And so the Trump administration is today doing what they wanted to do all along, indefinitely detain families and kick kids out of the country immediately when they get here by holding them in hotels with little oversight, no access to lawyers, and really no due process.
And thank you, Jacob, for being here with us tonight and for sharing so much of the background of this book with us.
Allison, thank you. And thank you to the American Writers Museum. And hi to all my friends in Chicago. And I'm grateful to everybody who came to this to the chat tonight. So have a good evening, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast, our final episode of the year. We're taking a couple weeks now to rest, but we will return in January with more fun, engaging, and inspiring conversations with contemporary writers. Have a great rest of the year and an even happier new year. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.